even our experiences may not have even been true. We were just giving you entertainment.
I was just about to say, in fact, everything we just said on the true on the show is not true. Welcome to the Ancestral Mind Podcast. My name is Colin Stuckert, founder of Wild Foods Co. and TheAncestralMind.com. I am here with my co-host, Brent Philbin, Crypto Basic podcast producer, speaker extraordinaire, and another guest from the same show, actually.
Yes, yes. So I'm a speaker, I'm a podcast producer, but the most important person for our podcast, the one who was the actual driving force, is here in Austin for South by Southwest. So we got him in the Wild studio to have a conversation. We're also here with Kareem Baruque.
Hey guys, excited to be here. Definitely feeling that intro music, by the way.
It's pretty dope, isn't it?
Absolutely.
So yeah. Kareem, what's your elevator pitch? Who are you? What do you do?
Well, so I'm a professional poker player, very interested in just history in general and scientific topics, and obviously also interested in crypto, and that led to a podcast with Brent and another friend that explored the topic.
I didn't realize you're a poker player. So actually what's funny is I've noticed that most of the winning players, and this is also true of a lot of the CEOs in Silicon Valley, they tend to be like closet philosophers, intellectuals.
Oh, he's not closet at all.
Well, a closet or out of the closet. To be good at something like poker or even just to be able to run a company and do things, you kind of have to be infinitely curious in that way.
Yeah, curiosity is definitely key there, I think.
Yeah, awesome. But so what are we going to talk about today, Brent?
Well, we were just chatting last night while we were on the tail end of another recording of a show, and psychedelics came up, which is a topic near and dear to Kareem's heart, a little bit near my heart, and Colin loves exploring it. So we thought, why don't we talk about psychedelics and really try to put the ancestral spin on them and how the medicine or whatever you want to call it, the piece of those plants that is able to affect the mind, how we found those, why it might matter, and what is interesting about that experience.
Brent, but like, say no to drugs. Dare. I grew up with Dare and all the Dare shirts. Like, you know, it's how can we talk about psychedelics? It's so not cool. It's drugs. It's bad.
We can't be promoting drug use.
Well, I mean, fundamentally we are though, right?
Yeah.
So so why and how? How can we do that? Because this is a show about people thinking ancestrally so they can live better.
Yeah.
So now we're talking about drugs. Like, what are you talking about? How did you convince me to do this?
We are talking about they're lumped in with drugs, but these are naturally occurring substances that are not man made. As far as I know, right?
Like, LSD is isolated, LSD so is. It depends. But okay. You know, but it has similar effect on the body in certain pathways to the more plant-based medicines, right?
So I think we should even just look at how we categorize drugs in general.
That's where I was going with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
like alcohol?
Well, exactly.
Caffeine, nicotine.
Exactly. Caffeine is, well, actually not even that. Food is the number one most abused drug in the world. And most people don't understand that, right? So think about what a drug is. You consume something, you put something in your body or your vein or whatever, and then there's a chemical reaction in your body. It is no different than food. Obviously, we're talking about like the hormonal effect of food the other day. And when you started, Kareem, you were talking about how when you start understanding that, it completely changed your paradigm of what food is, right? And that's how everybody needs to think about it, right? And that's why things like keto and low carb and then understanding insulin, things like that is like the whole new kind of diet movement right now, because we're starting to accept the reality that food is a drug, but in the same way, it's also medicine, right? It's also the most abused drug in the world, as we now see with our obesity epidemic in America. So in that vein, like, you know, psychedelics is based, a lot of it's plant-based, right?
Yes.
And so it has a chemical reaction in the body.
Fungus-based, Well,
technically no, but it's, in fact, fungi, the kingdom is a little bit closer to the animal kingdom than it is the plant kingdom,
right?
It's actually its own thing. And that's kind of maybe something we talk about as we get into the show, but
But Colin, I think the example that you're giving with food is a perfect example, because it wouldn't make sense to say that food is bad or good, because we have to understand that there's just a huge difference between a donut and a piece of salmon. So in the same way, trying to categorize drugs in general under one blanket is counterproductive.
Well,
because
yes, that's a good example. So food can be good and can be bad, right? You can even take an example of a donut. If you're starving, walking through the desert, and you come across a box of donuts, that is going to be a life-saving box of donuts. It's the best thing you could ever have. So in that way, in that instance, in that circumstance, food would be good, right? For the average person that eats too much, eats too many carbs, whatever, donuts are the worst thing you can have, right?
Absolutely.
And so there's a full spectrum of different variables. And obviously the body, the human body is a complex organism, right? There's things that we know for sure. Like we know that there's certain responses of certain foods like carbs and fats and proteins and how they work in your body. And so the same thing with the plant kingdom. Like,
and the analogy extends even further, I think, when you're talking about the donut, for example, because there are drugs that in an isolated use are not really going to be that dangerous to your body, mm-hmm. but it's the consistent use, the long-term use that creates so much stress on your body.
Or
and
abuse.
The same goes for things yeah. like, you know, let's say cocaine or methamphetamines or MDMA mm-hmm. are things that isolated uses are not going to kill you. But however, what ends up happening is people abuse these and their inner chemistry is completely, you know, messed up and mm-hmm. often has permanent effects.
Yep. I mean, well, we all know what happens if you eat too much food. We also know what happens if you don't eat enough food. You literally can die on each end of the spectrum, right?
Yep.
Which is why you have to find the golden mean. As Aristotle talked about, most things in life are right in the middle of the left and the right. Right. So when it comes to drugs, the thing that really sold me on psychedelics was the fact that, like, let's just say LSD, that's the primary one that I've done. And I've microdosed, I've done like a half dose before. I've never done like a full triple dose. Like my buddy Monsel's like, you have to do it. It's going to change your life. I'm a little hesitant to do it actually. Right. But that's kind of the thing. It's like this drug, which everyone thinks is like, oh, it's addictive. It's going to ruin your life. It actually has a natural way to prevent you from using it too much. And the number one way it does that is if you take it every single day, the effects actually wear off, right? So like if you take it 7 days in a row, by day seven, you probably won't even feel anything. That's not the case with alcohol or downers or cocaine. You actually have to do more to get the same effect, right? So it's a reverse thing. And so when I started thinking about that, I'm like, interesting. Everything I've been taught about drugs going up was like, it's going to ruin your life. You're going to become addicted. You're going to become a cokehead or a pothead or whatever. And like, there's a lot of legitimacy to that with certain substances, right? Psychedelics is, at least LSD in my experience, maybe you could talk about some of the things you've done and their effects, but from what I've understood is psychedelics tend to prevent the user from using them too much or too often.
Yeah, and they're just fundamentally different because they don't activate the same reward systems in the brain that cause a lot of the addiction that we see with things like cocaine and alcohol, mm-hmm. right? So a lot of these drugs, what they're using is capitalizing on your dopamine reward system, mm-hmm. and then you become addicted. So in a very real way, something like pornography or looking at Reddit is more addicting than something like LSD,
yep.
or psilocybin or dimethyltryptamine. So again, just because this is why it's so unproductive to label something just drugs, because they're yep. so different and the effects that they have are so different. And as a matter of fact, as I'm sure we'll get into, psilocybin and LSD in particular are used to break addiction habits.
Yeah, and that's where all the cool research is coming out. Like Tim Ferriss is a big proponent. He's funding research. They're using psilocybin. I think they're testing almost every psychedelic there is. Maybe you can help me. You know, there's peyote, there's ayahuasca, there's LSD. You know, and these are more of the pure form psychedelics. Obviously, LSD is from my understanding, it is a extract or it's synthesized
it's
or something.
Synthesized,
you know,
from like a, I believe rye or something.
Yeah,
like that.
But yeah. It's not the same as like what are the projects like Molly where they like add like maybe uppers or downers to it, which then you can get into real issues with. Right.
So for example, when you're talking about ecstasy, old ecstasy used to be mixed with other things, but the main ingredient there is MDMA, right? Mm-hmm. So like pure MDMA in theory is not as bad for you as ecstasy, but here's where the problem goes. When you take MDMA, your brain is flooded with additional dopamine and the receptors, which the uptake receptors, which reduce that, get basically put away. So your body, in order to make up for the extra dopamine in your brain, increases the amount of receptors. Mm-hmm. So what happens the next day? You're still generating a normal amount of dopamine, but you have so many more reuptake processes coming in that you feel depressed because you don't even feel your normal level of satisfaction or pleasure, right? So prolonged use of even very pure MDMA will completely mess up your reward system.
Is MDMA falling into the psychedelic category?
No. Well, it depends, actually. There's in some very slight ways you can, and actually MDMA has been used also for PTSD and depression, mm-hmm. but I think that it's pretty clear that the negative effects of MDMA are significantly worse. Acid and psilocybin literally have no addictive properties.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that there's no behavioral addiction. Of course,
sure.
Anybody can become addicted to a behavior or an experience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, anything. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why you have to be careful with putting things in blanket categories and black and white boxes. There's a lot of variables to everything. You know, things aren't good or bad, but things can always be good or bad at the same time, right? So it just really depends. My experience is with LSD. Brent, do you have an experience with anything like this in the spectrum? I mean, where are you coming from?
I have used the truffles in Amsterdam, which are somewhat analogous to mushrooms, I guess. And I have also done LSD after a long road of convincing and asking. And
how much?
It's a good question.
You took half a tab, I believe.
I was with Kareem when I did it. So.
What was the experience like?
So for me, the entire time, I kept thinking about what it was doing. So I was more interested in, rather than like seeing visions or whatever, I was more interested in why I was seeing them. So while I was doing it, I kept imagining like ghosts in my peripheral vision. And it was interesting to me because clearly it was stimulating my brain, and it was also, for whatever reason, accessing my fear center. So it wasn't like I was super scared, but my brain was filling in my peripheral vision with something that was scary enough to get me to look at it. So we were in this cabin in the woods, and there was this kayak up against a tree. We were outside, and my brain was like all about that kayak. I just kept turning around thinking that kayak was something different each time. But when I looked at it, it looked normal. Mm-hmm. And then there was something like there was a meteor shower, and I was up trying to look at it, and I was having this interesting conversation in my mind where I was like, I don't know if I'm looking at I could be making that up.
Yep.
Okay. So this is, I would love to jump in here because I remember that moment very specifically. Something that Brent said to me in that moment was, I want to be able to distinguish. I want to know what's real and what I'm making up in my brain. And actually, I feel like that's the fundamental question that psychedelics makes you face, because the one of the most powerful truths for me about psychedelics is that it makes you realize that there is not really a reality out there. What happens is that reality is synthesized in the brain every single waking moment. You are incapable of experiencing reality as it is, because that's not how the brain works. You don't see an entire spectrum of color. We don't experience all kinds of waves and signals. We're just not designed to experience it that way. When you take psychedelics, it's like the filter through which you interpret reality is slightly switched. Mm-hmm. And each psychedelic can slightly switch in a different way. And you start realizing that it's all much more abstract than we give it credit for. That, you know, like you, Brent saying, oh, what is real and what am I making up in my brain? I want to say, no. Literally everything we've ever experienced is being made up in our brain.
And there's no such thing as colors. Yeah. That freaks people out, right? Yeah. Because some people are so tied into what they perceive is their life, their ego, their person, what they see is real or whatever. But it's like, you know, you have people like Elon Musk talking about how we're probably in a simulation and things like that, you know? And I've always been fascinated by things like that too. Like I had a friend that did ayahuasca down in Peru. He's gone actually twice. He was literally convinced that their demons exist because he saw them. And I was trying to say, well, okay, but your brain manifested something. And now you're so committed to that is reality and real because you saw it. But dude, it's like, we know that the brain, you can literally pump it full of things and it'll just do weird shit. We already know that, right? So like, how can you possibly now, after you've gone through the experience, adamantly say, I believe there's demons because I saw them, you know?
And not to get too tangential, but this is one of the core tenets of scientific skepticism, right? Why is anecdotal evidence not considered solid evidence? It's not because we think people are lying. When people say, you don't understand, I saw a ghost. You don't understand, I experienced XYZ. Okay, no, you don't understand. I'm not saying that you didn't experience that. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to tell you is that just because you experience something doesn't mean that it's in the external world. Yep. The brain, the most powerful and complex thing that we know of, is able to synthesize entire realities. How do we know that? Because you do it every night when you go to sleep. You can create entire worlds, right? Mm-hmm. Even with your eyes closed. So just because we're receiving sensory input and sometimes we have an experience that seems out of the ordinary, doesn't mean that we tapped into a new layer of reality. It means that your brain created something unique.
Right. And so that's where the benefit is, though, I think. Because it helps people break through their rigid attachment to only what they can see, touch, and feel, right? It helps them maybe open up a little bit and say like, oh, I don't know, because, you know, like when I was on these drugs, my brain did all these crazy things. I didn't know what was real, what wasn't. And I think that's what people need more of. And I think that's why it can be so therapeutic, because people get so wrapped up in whatever their brain, whether it's depression or PTSD, their brain manifests things and they can't kind of figure out a way to deal with it or to maybe detach from it a little bit. They get so wrapped up in it. And then you have a lot of issues. Like most of our society are just basically sleepwalking zombies, in my opinion, right?
There's actually very specific evidence to back up what you're saying, Colin, because one of the very interesting studies that has been done is looking at people who are doing LSD under an MRI. And one of the things that they found, so usually the way the brain works is as you're getting older, information is being created through networks and patterns in the brain, right? So like when you recreate a memory, it's a specific network of neurons that have fused, right? So as we get older, our habits and our worldviews and our thoughts, they kind of become ingrained in the brain. Literally, like you can see the physical structure of the paths, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that LSD does is it breaks down a lot of those processes. And under an MRI, we can see that areas of the brain that normally are not communicating start communicating. So for example, why can you have closed eye visuals? Well, it turns out that even after you close your eyes, we're seeing in the MRI that the visual centers of the brain are communicating with all different parts of the brain that normally wouldn't. Mm-hmm. So you're taking information from your subconscious and it's being projected into your visual center, even though your eyes are closed. And the brain actually does this in its entirety. You also see, we see like the dissolution of parts of people experience, oh, I don't have a sense of the self. Again, we see the parts of the brain that are in charge of structuring your sense of self and separating yourself from the rest of reality, we see that it becomes disorganized and it starts communicating with other parts of the brain. So it creates a very unique experience, which is why psychedelics can be so transformative, because it just puts you in a mental state that you've never been in. So, and after you come out of it, you're just like, damn, I didn't even know that this was possible. Feeling this way was possible, or seeing that perception was possible. You know,
it opened you up. It's absolutely like, you know. And I think we need more people opening up, like in our social media, you know, siloed echo chamber world that's becoming more and more divisive, more and more left versus right, whatever. Like, we need more people to just say, no, I don't need to commit to left versus right. In fact, I'm more interested in what's in the middle. I'm more interested in like, where is the truth in what you're saying, and where's the truth in what you're saying, and then the truth is somewhere in the middle. And yeah, it's a messy, gray, fuzzy area. But again, Aristotle was saying it, you know, 2,000 years ago, whatever. Like the best things in life, and even nature has an equilibrium. It's a golden mean, right? And that's why we're talking about this ancestral mind. Everything in our environment has a golden mean. So like, just enough exercise, not too much exercise. Right? Just enough food, not too much, not too little, right? Sunlight, if you don't get it, you'll get rickets and you could die from not having vitamin D, right? If you go in the sunlight every day, all day, you can die, right? So like, everything has this golden mean equilibrium. And I think psychedelics are just so amazing because it can help people get more to that middle gray area. That's what I think the big benefit is for most people, and just open up and, like you said, break some of those connections of the dogma, right? But what about psychedelics compared to like alcohol, downers, amphetamines, other things like that, which seem to have more of a negative effect, right? And a very temporary positive one, but a much bigger negative. Whereas what I've seen is psychedelics tend to have a very big upside. And even sometimes like you can have bad trips or whatever, even like a negative experience going through it. But then afterwards you have a really positive effect usually, right? But compare that to, you know, the traditional drugs people do.
Yeah. So, you know, I agree with you over on the general concept that psychedelics, especially when you're looking at long-term effect, I mean, this has been studied like very thoroughly. People experience higher sense of openness, agreeableness. They feel empathy. More connection. Confidence actually goes up after psychedelic use. However, a bad psychedelic experience can be traumatizing in a way that, like, you know, getting blackout drunk is not going to. So you're just dealing with a more powerful tool. Mm-hmm. And I think that power cuts both ways, even though it tends to cut in a positive light. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, obviously, it's set and setting. And again, comparing it back to when we're talking about uppers, downers, alcohol, dope, all these things that, again, are just playing on your reward centers are different. Even though psychedelics can do that. So for example, mushrooms can help you feel upbeat. You know, LSD can help you experience music and all that stuff in different ways. But again, it's one is about fundamentally changing perception, whereas the other one is about different forms of pleasure or reducing inhibition or things of that nature.
So it's chemical.
To me, it's all chemical.
So
right?
Well, right, but like, if psychedelics would you say? And I'm generally curious here. I don't know the answer. Is it a brain chem? Well, obviously, even dopamine's in the brain. So like, what are the chemical pathways that psychedelics are kind of triggering so that you're not getting the same effect as something like alcohol or downers, which are more like a dopamine receptor and serotonin it messes with usually. Like, yeah. And how? What are those pathways?
Yeah. So, okay. So let's use the example of MDMA, right? MDMA, as we talked before, is taking away the dopamine reuptake system. So it's still your own dopamine system that's flooding the brain, right?
So is it releasing more dopamine?
You're releasing more dopamine and you're also taking up less dopamine.
So what do you mean by taking up less dopamine?
Well, so your brain has a system through which it cycles dopamine. Just like you're releasing it into the brain, you have to have a way to also take it back up.
Yeah.
Right? So we have all kinds of different receptors that are matching up. And as a quick tangential here, to answer your question specifically, what's really interesting about some of these chemicals is that the molecular shape of the particle itself is similar to something we have in our body. And then that's why they're able to interact with our brain, but they do so differently. So let's look at, for example, marijuana, right? When you look at cannabis, THC, THC is able to interact in the brain because we have something in our brain called cannabinoids, endocannabinoids, mm-hmm. right? They have a similar shape, but they're slightly different. So when the THC interacts with the cannabinoid receptors, we have a unique experience. And in the same way, when we take LSD, is we have receptors in our brain that can process similar molecules, mm-hmm. but these are slightly different molecules, and therefore they create slightly or significantly different experiences on the conscious self. But is it a chemical? Yeah, look, at the end of the day, we are a chemical soup. That is what we mm-hmm. are. We are just a collection of chemicals, and even our hormonal changes when we have more testosterone, our aggression, our passivity, our experience, like experiencing love, all of that is a series of chemicals going on in the brain, you know, and how they interact with our anatomical structures.
Well, does science know why something like a downer, alcohol or whatever, what pathways and things that is doing, or is it too complex for us to really know compared to like something like ayahuasca or LSD, for example?
Well, so look, when it comes to ayahuasca, so the active effect, the active chemical in ayahuasca is dimethyltryptamine, okay. right? So there's two ways. Here's what happens with DMT. It actually gets synthesized by the body so quickly that if you eat DMT, like if I could just give you a rock of DMT and you ate it, you wouldn't experience anything off it, because by the time it could get to your brain, your body's already disappeared.
Okay.
So that's why you smoke it, right? Because it goes straight to the brain and you have a very short 10-minute experience. You experience it and then the brain synthesizes it and it's gone. Well,
so ayahuasca, though, is more of a drink, right?
Right. So what the ancient, what the South American tribes figured out is they can take the plant that has the dimethyltryptamine, the DMT, and they mix it with another plant that interferes with your digestive tract. That's why when you take ayahuasca, you tend to vomit a lot, or you can have like diarrhea and things like that.
That prevents it from getting to the brain too fast?
That prevents it from the body breaking it down too fast so that it has time to get to your brain. And that's why it stays so much longer, because you have this amount that just keeps feeding to the brain, and there's an inhibitor blocking your brain, your body from being able to break it down. Mm. So you have a longer experience, but it's still the DMT molecule specifically that's interacting. And if you look, like if you Google them, a lot of them have very similar shapes. A lot of these psychedelics, the actual molecular structure is similar. And that's why they're able to interact with the brain.
Hmm. Brent, you have any questions over there?
No, this is all nuts. I haven't gone into a lot of this. I know that the DMT that you're talking about is supposed to basically be the most intense thing, and the reason there's ayahuasca shamans and stuff like that, it is like as real and intense as any of those trips can be, basically, right?
Yeah, but again, so two things here. When we're talking about intensity, we're always talking about subjective experience, so it's really hard to break that up. And from a practical perspective, yes, a DMT trip is significantly more powerful than your average acid trip, but don't forget that DMT is measured in grams. So like if you wanted to have the DMT experience, you're going to smoke, have that breakthrough experience that we're talking about, you're going to smoke, let's say, half a dime, which is, you know, an amount of grams. LSD is measured in micrograms. So if we went pound per pound, there's a good chance that LSD is much more powerful, but nobody's going to take that amount of LSD because you would be tripping for...
Well, I know some people have taken... five tabs or full tabs before.
Again, we're talking about micrograms still, right?
Yeah.
So like it's hard to say most powerful, but here's the other thing about DMT, which is similar to a psychedelic called salvia, which is LSD interacts with the real world. Like you're still walking through the real world, you're experiencing, just like psilocybin, just like mushrooms, and the stronger the dose is, the more immersive it can be. But DMT genuinely, literally feels like you travel to a different dimension. So it's just... it's beyond immersive. There's no other way to explain it. Like it's so powerful that like, so for example, I come from a more scientific skeptical worldview. So I don't believe that if you take DMT, you're traveling to another dimension.
Mm-hmm, sure.
But it's so hard to find anybody in the DMT community that doesn't believe they travel to another dimension because the experience is so real.
So that's
huge turnoff for me. But
yeah, but here's the thing. It's like the one friend that had the demon experience was basically like, well, you can't understand until you do it. And yeah, sure, I can't, right? I can't fully understand what he saw. And if I saw that, what I would believe. But I also really dogmatically, even though I don't like being dogmatic about a lot of things, believe that I would still understand that it is my brain manifesting things I saw. And I think people can't objectively understand that that is like the basic biology of how their body works, right? They see something and they believe it's so true because it's right there, right? And their brain tells them it's right there. They can't touch it, but they can see it, right? I would believe that I would understand it's just my brain basically playing tricks on me, right? But until I do it, I don't know though. Like maybe I would like completely change my idea if I literally saw something.
Right. So that's why we go back to the fundamental understanding of how the brain works, because your friend, whether he addresses it or not, ultimately his worldview still tells him that what he experiences is reality.
What he sees is
that
reality.
His brain's job is to tell him what's happening.
So, or tell him the truth.
Exactly.
Yes.
So that's why when they experience something else, their explanation tends to be, oh, well, this must have unlocked a door or a dimension that wasn't there before.
Yep.
So look, I think that there's two general worldviews when it comes to psychedelics. One is that because they're so powerful, people feel like, oh, it's unlocking an underlying dimension. Like you access the truth of the universe. But another view, the one that I hold to, is that really what happens with consciousness is that it's an emergent property of the brain. So you have this soup of chemicals and neurons and interactions that create something new, which is consciousness, in the same way that a very unique set of code and hardware can create Windows or Apple or whatever. It's like software. So consciousness is the software of the wetware of the mind. What happens with LSD or dimethyltryptamine to me is that you add a very powerful ingredient to the recipe and it creates something uniquely new. But just because I had an experience doesn't mean that I now know something about the nature of reality. And actually, I would argue that that's a pretty arrogant worldview in a way, because it doesn't put us in the right context, right? Which is one of many, many animals in a tiny, tiny rock floating around one of many, many stars in one of billions of galaxies, right? So does your brain have the power to unlock the truth of the universe because you took this one chemical, or did this one chemical alter your conscious state?
Yeah. And then, you know, it's like, what is truth? I've thought about that a lot. Like, truth, is truth what you touch? Well, when you touch something, it sends a signal to your brain, right? And they've done all kinds of studies with things. It kind of reminds me of like the allegory of the cave thing with Socrates and things like that. And, you know, I just don't understand why it's so hard for humans to comprehend that what they might see or what their brain tells them they might see, touch, or feel, right? How they can so trust that so blindedly, right? Like you've heard of, it also reminds me of an episode of House where the guy has like phantom pain. Right. Oh, where he basically lost his leg or something, but he has pain in the area that he lost, and House like kidnaps him and like does this thing to basically help it go away. And the guy was so thankful afterwards, even though he basically kidnapped the guy and like held him against his will. But it's like that. Can you say that guy's pain isn't there? Right. Like, no, obviously it's there, but it's not there because the limb is there. It's there because of some weird malfunction of the brain.
Okay,
right.
So I have to touch on this because it's so fascinating. Phantom pain was such a mystery for so long, and it is still kind of a mystery. Mm-hmm. But one of the guys that basically won a Nobel Prize for this, and I'm going to butcher his last name, but I want to say it's like Dr. Ramachandran or something along those lines. But he had a patient with phantom limb, and one of the things that he noticed with many of his patients with phantom limbs is that all of them had their amputated arm in a cast for a prolonged period of time. So let's say they got an accident, then they were kind of wrapped up for, like, let's say 2 months, 3 months or whatever. And then finally the doctors are like, yeah, we're going to have to amputate, right? Those were the people that tended to have phantom pain, not the people that got an accident and lost their arm. So what he was able to posit was that throughout that period of time where the arm was unresponsive, when the patient was trying to send a signal to the brain to move the hand couldn't. So over a long period of time, the brain learned that that hand was unresponsive. When it was amputated, that learned behavior was still there. He was able to cure him with the simplest, cheapest cure you could ever imagine. He created a box with a mirror on it. And he told the patient, I want you to put your real arm, the one you can control, on this side. So on the other one, you see the reflection. And then I want you to put the phantom arm, the one you don't have, behind it. And I want you to
the brain.
Move them at the same time. And the patient's like, you know, I can't move my phantom arm. And he's like, just try it. So he's moving this finger and he's seeing the reflection. And now that the brain is getting the visual reflection, he was able to start moving his phantom arm. And with practice, he took the box home, and within 3 weeks, the phantom limb was gone and the phantom pain was gone.
I think House did something like that, like some weird, easy thing that was so obvious, he cured the guy.
That's based on a real story of Dr. Ramachandran. Unbelievable.
That's crazy.
And again, it comes back to the basic fact that we have to distinguish between our conscious experience, what the brain is synthesizing for us, that's different than what's out there, which is why when we're trying to understand how the world works, and this is not to say, I want to make something very clear. This is not to say that the conscious experience is not valuable. Of course it's valuable. It's the most valuable thing, how we, our happiness, our world, all that stuff is very important. But when we're trying to understand how the world works, it's the scientific method. It's science, experimentation, hypothesis, proof, analysis, you know what I'm saying? Peer review, like this is how we understand how the world works. And when we want to talk about the conscious experience, we can use science to educate how the world really works. And then we can look at, there's still a ton of value. Of course, there's spiritual value, growth, all these kinds of things can still be true without us assuming that whatever we experience must be the truth.
Mm-hmm. And I think what you made me think of saying that is psychedelics and just a fundamental understanding of these things, people need to understand that their consciousness, their thoughts, their beliefs, their worldviews is malleable.
Exactly.
And that is the ultimate power. That's why every secret thing or like positive affirmation, whatever, is about trying to basically convince yourself to believe absolutely in you, that you can do something or whatever. And they kind of say, like, anyone successful is like, I had to basically believe before I could do it. Until I believed it, I couldn't do it. Right. And then people try to teach that after the fact. But it's a very hard thing to learn because, like, again, our brains and our consciousness have a set of heuristics and dogmas that basically are designed to keep us alive in the wild, right? Like, we had to always be skeptical of the unknown. We had to be skeptical of other people that weren't the same skin color as us that we didn't know, like Brent and I have talked about on the show. In fact, Brent, why is that the case from an ancestral perspective? Why can we, let's just say, even be naturally racist or biased in these ways?
Because our ancestors who weren't that way got killed because they were killed by the other tribes that were actually out to kill them.
Or the one in 10 that might have.
Yeah, bad one, if they weren't skeptical and they were just like, yeah, we love everybody, they would
right.
die.
And especially when it's somebody that, like, completely different skin color, different language like that. Like, you have no idea if they're warlike, if they're friendly or whatever. And like we talked about, there was a period in time where there might have been 1 million humans on the planet. Most tribes would have gone their entire lives without seeing other humans. So if you come across a human for the first time in 20 years and you're not careful, well, like, we know if one's slightly aggressive or more warlike and they want what you have, they want your women, your children, or whatever you happen to have, like, or maybe fighting over a kill, like, the not careful tribe is going to be weeded out very quickly, right? And that's why, and those survivors that were careful and that were fearful of the unknown are our ancestors, because they survived and everyone else that wasn't careful did not survive.
And yep. That's okay. Why it's so important when we're talking about evolutionary theory to understand that it doesn't say that we are quote unquote evolving to either our better selves or whatever you think is good or bad.
Yep.
Evolution is strictly about what increases survival.
In the environment, correct. Which is why today, right? I talk about how I believe that the 20th century is going to be the next epoch of human evolution. In 1,000, 2,000 years, scientists are going to look back and they're going to say humans that devolved when food became ubiquitous and, you know, all the modern comforts or whatever, that's one subsect. Maybe that's Homo sapiens 1.0, right? The humans that evolved, were able to survive during that time are going to be the progenitors of the next evolution, Homo sapiens 2.0, right? Because if you look at, and the gap's widening, the majority of people, you know, it's almost 50% obesity rate in the United States, for example. They are unfortunately devolving as a result of our modern environment. Those that are fit, healthy, having lots of kids, making money, whatever, you know, they really are kind of the survivals. They are the Darwin survivors of our current environment. And like, if this keeps going the way it's going, you know, we already see heart disease and cancer are the two number one killers in our country, right?
Yeah.
It's, I always talk about how like Darwin would be so shocked to see his theory of natural selection happening to his own species at such a rapid pace, like that has happened in the past 50 years. Right.
Yeah.
And it's just getting worse. Now, India and China are becoming two of the fastest growing obesity rates in the world because they're getting all the processed food. They're becoming more fluent. It's just so, yeah, bad thing. But
one thing worth mentioning, though, just to put a little bit more of a hopeful spin on it, is that it takes time for a society or a culture to recognize a problem from the time that it arises. Right. So if you really think about how long have we had the modern food processes, how long have we had what we consider the modern, let's say it's supply chains and everything like that. It really hasn't been that long. Right. Mm-hmm. It's been less than 150 years. So in less than 150 years, we've had enough time to see a couple of generations go through this process and start identifying that we have a problem. And we're already seeing massive shifts, especially as you go with younger generations trying to redirect it. The same thing with smoking, right? Like cigarettes, we didn't, like, they were ubiquitous. We didn't realize how bad they were. It took time to first learn that they were that bad. Then you have to spread the message that they're that bad.
There were still smoking sections in restaurants like 10 years ago.
Your gynecologist would be smoking a cigarette while he's...
Well, doctors used to recommend cigarettes.
Exactly.
But, yeah. So
all I'm saying here is that we are, yes, we're seeing some very big problems, but at the same time, let's recognize that a lot of them are problems that we just realized and that we've already started trying to tackle. And the amazing thing about humans is that we are extremely intelligent and extremely adaptable. And as problems arise, we tend to tackle them. So there's a good chance I would not be surprised. We might not be around, but I would not be surprised if in, you know, the year 2080 or 2090 or 2100, they're talking about the obesity epidemics of the, you know, 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, that by the time you get to the 2080s, 2090s, we've addressed because we've changed how we consume food, how we, you know, our supply chains, and not to mention, of course, that we are starting to unlock the secrets of genetics. So we're the first species that's going to be able to take evolution into their own hands.
Right. But so how many people are going to die before then? Well, and that's why we do what we do, yeah. Right? My goal is to save as many people as possible.
Of course.
Because they're every single day, I mean, it's hundreds of thousands of people are dying from preventable, like totally preventable. A lot of people think a lot of modern disease is like, I got bad genetics. That's fucking bullshit. Most people are literally dying because of the way they live their everyday lives.
That's right.
Right. And so if you look at, so it reminds me of England, there was this moth. It was a white moth. And when they started burning a lot of coal around maybe early 1900s or whatever, that moth basically evolved to become black. Right. In a very short period of time, because moths have a fast life cycle. So you can kind of observe, right? Humans have average life cycle of like 60 to 80 years. So generations take time to go through. But this moth, because it can replicate so fast, it basically in a short period of time went from white moss to black moss, right? Because that was a response to the environment. And those moths survived. A lot of white moths died during that process, right? Then though, when they stopped burning as much coal, the shit, they literally evolved back to white moss again, right? And a lot of black moths died. So it's like, absolutely, but this is natural selection happening. And it's unfortunate that like there are positive trends, but the obesity rate is still climbing. In fact, our children's generation is now for the first time in human history going to have shorter lifespans in aggregate than their, like think about that for a second. My son's generation and his cohorts are going to have shorter average lifespans than my generation.
Okay, but so
based on the numbers and the trends, right?
I would disagree because I think we're going to solve a lot more problems.
No, I'm saying based on actual numbers.
No, okay. So two things. Yes, the life expectancy is going down. A lot of that has to do with suicide and opioids, right? But again, going back to the idea, like, look, you understand that we have the information available to not make these mistakes. But if you think of human society as a network, right? Imagine all the nodes. The actual information has to physically still travel to all the different nodes. So just because this information has been around for 10 or 15, 20 years, that doesn't mean that there's been enough time for this information to travel across all the nodes, go to the centers of decision, and start affecting change. This is why I'm saying the societal change takes time. Mm-hmm. But we're still going to shift gears in a positive direction because this is a problem that's been identified. It's a modern problem, right? Modern problems require modern solutions, but the problem has to arise first. It has to be identified first. The solution has to be identified. And then that information has to travel through all the nodes in the network. And you are one of those early nodes, but that doesn't mean the information is not traveling. It's traveling quickly and it's going to change.
Yeah. And I'm not debating that it's not traveling. I'm kind of saying that I maybe am not as optimistic as you are, because if you look at the modern landscape of pop culture diet, everyone talks about how vegans and plants are the health food of the century. And now you have the carnivore movement, which is kind of shedding some light on how that's just very much a fallacy. It's very much based in politicking and an agenda and veganism and all this nonsense. And it's like the average person still thinks like a vegan diet is healthy. And I'm adamantly like, no, a vegan diet is not healthy, right? And so these are just examples of like, I think eventually, and then hopefully like Brendan's saying, we will. And this is my response to climate change. I think we will eventually solve climate change through innovation, right? Either, you know, if like...
We might be fucked. That might be the only way we have the option to solve it.
We probably do, right? And that's why like Elon wants to get off the planet or whatever, right? Because maybe he doesn't have as much faith that that's going to happen. Right. I think we will. You have people that talk about overpopulation. I've always been like, you know, and they're like, save the earth, whatever. But I'm like, I'm more for saving the human species than I am for saving the earth. Like, we can always populate the stars if we need to, right? The more humans alive, the more innovation, the more scientists, the more ability we might have to evolve and get off this rock. Whereas people are like scarcity minded. We're like, no, you have to recycle more and use less and consume less and have less kids because you're just killing the environment.
And just to be clear, we're not even close to overpopulated. I mean, like you can look it up.
Wait till we can mine asteroids too.
Yeah, like, the entire population of the world could fit in the state of Texas with the population density of like New York.
Yeah, but these are prevalent dogmas, right? That slow the evolutionary timeline of like solving modern problems, right? And you have things like billionaires don't cooperate, countries don't cooperate. They all just want to like live their short lives with as much resource as possible. If we all we were all invaded by some climate change alien or something, we would all band together. We would band together and we would try to solve it.
Yeah.
And you know how much resources we have on the planet that is just sitting in people's accounts because they want to make more money or whatever. If we ever had a united human front, which like I told you, the only way we're ever going to officially end tribalism and racism is when we get invaded by aliens, because then it's us versus them.
Yeah.
Humans have to have a them. Right now, the them is people that are different than them, right? But when aliens come, everybody has a them. It's like Independence Day, right? And everyone's fighting together alongside each other. And then we officially end interhuman racism. Then it'll just be like, now we're racist against all the other aliens that we come across in the universe, right?
And the last thing I'll say to add that positive spin again is that as the pressure for something like climate change increases because the effects are more tangible, mm-hmm. then the incentive for all the different human populations to address the problem becomes higher and higher.
Yep.
Eventually, that reaches an equilibrium point where it becomes a priority. And you're already starting to see it, I think, mm-hmm. little by little. Of course, there's political structures that make it difficult. Of course, there's social structures. There's self-interest. There's industry. Mm-hmm. But again, these problems take time. And it's difficult for us as actors who are just, you know, we're just born in a random place, like random place, random time. And we're in the middle of one of the major problems.
Mm-hmm.
But I am hopeful about like that incentive structure changing over time and mm-hmm. being addressed more quickly.
Yeah, I'm totally an optimist as well. I just try to scare people a bit more and pander to them less, because the reality is a friend of ours the other day found a tumor. In fact, her sister walked in the room. Like, that's how close it is.
Yeah.
Our buddy Logan almost died from brain cancer at the age of fucking 21. Like, this shit is not stuff you want to beat around the fucking bush. This is shit that people need to understand. You still have the big food industries and the pharmaceuticals and all these massive multi-trillion dollar machines that are incentivized to keep the average person a sick, fat, tired consumer that then pays his taxes and is in debt and credit card debt and all this bullshit, right? And so, yeah, I'm just a little bit more fucking pissed off about it than you are, man.
This is a great psychedelics conversation. Well,
but so these are the things. And this is why I love psychedelics, because they maybe push you to think about these things. They push you to go to these places and they push you to open your mind to challenge your dogma and your belief system, right? Now, but what about like, what can someone do if they want to try psychedelics? Like, what can, you know, what, how did you start with that? You know, like, what was your first experience? Cause mine was I learned about microdosing, I think through Tim Ferriss or something like that, right? My buddy had a good source that I trust. So he got me this little stamp and he said, literally cut off like an itsy bitsy corner and put it under your tongue. Okay. That was my first experience with psychedelics. And it was basically like kind of an aggressive caffeine high that made think colors a little bit more colorful. I wasn't like seeing things. I've actually never had that experience where I've hallucinated ever. And, you know, maybe I need to do a lot more to get that experience. But for me, I don't even know if it's super necessary. I'll probably do it eventually, but I don't really see, like, that's not my goal. I don't need to have a hallucinogenic experience. I probably should, but it's not a goal.
Right. But don't think of it as just after you cross a certain threshold, that's when you have the hallucinogenic experience. And do I want to have that experience or not? But what actually ends up happening with a lot of these is that at small quantities, they all have very similar experiences. So if you take a little bit of mushrooms, you take a little bit of LSD.
So you can microdose almost everything.
You can microdose almost anything. And at lower experiences, what you end up getting is that little bit of a body high, a little bit of like an upbeat. But the more of the specific drug you take, the more that the specific quality of that drug makes itself clear in your experience.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, at higher doses, something like acid is going to give you a hallucinogenic experience. But there are other experiences that are coming along with that higher dose. It's not just the fact that you're having hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fact that those hallucinations are, let's say, for example, you're listening to music and you close your eyes. What you're getting is your brain creating a masterpiece of color and vision and visuals that goes perfectly synced to the music. And you're going to experience levels of synesthesia, if you guys are familiar with the concept where your senses get mixed up. So some people, some people that have synesthesia,
can you define that?
So synesthesia is in certain individuals' brains in the population, your brain will experience, let's say, crosswire different circuits. So these are people who, for example, hear when they hear music, every single note has a specific color. So they see like pink when they see a D flat, and they see purple. So many professional musicians, for example, they are playing the violin and they actually see a concert of colors.
Yeah. Isn't that also like on the autism spectrum sometimes, or Asperger's, and that makes them very good at some things like maybe math, for example, because they can visualize it in a different way?
There is a lot of crossover. And for example, one of the guys, there was a documentary, The Smartest Guy in the World, the person who has the world record for how long they can recite the number pi. He has synesthesia with numbers. Mm-hmm. So when he sees numbers on a whiteboard, he actually sees shapes. And the reason he's able to do very complex mathematical calculations in his mind, and we're talking about like, you know, 1.3 million divided by 700,000 or the square root of this, and to the many decimal points. And yeah, he could do this very quickly, but he says that he's not doing math in his head. He sees two shapes, and when the numbers mix, he sees a new shape,
yeah,
right? So that's what synesthesia is. And actually psychedelics seem to have similar experience, where all of a sudden you're listening to music, but you're experiencing it in a very different way. Not only are you getting colors in your mind, but your body itself, like when the music drops, you feel a specific drop. It's a sense of merging with the music. And that experience of ego death, for example, mm-hmm, where you start being unable to tell the difference between your environment and yourself, that applies with all the sensory input that you're experiencing. So when people say, oh, well, you know, I'm not that really interested in the, let's say, just the visuals of it, understand that the visuals are one component of a complex conscious experience that is unique and often transcendental and paradigm switching.
So how does this help someone in their everyday life? The ego death, for sure, right? And maybe we can unpack that. But the average person, why would they want to do a psychedelic experience if they've never done it?
I mean, so I think the number
one— your opinion,
because yeah, there's right, obviously— Yeah, of course, subjective. It's just an opinion. Sure. But for me, it's just the main idea of seeing the different filters of reality. You know, if at the end of the day, going back to this idea that reality is being synthesized in the brain, mm-hmm, think of this as an opportunity to experience reality in a different way. To literally, I mean, sometimes it feels like you're seeing colors than that you haven't seen before. When I had my DMT breakthrough, I've genuinely, it's almost impossible to describe, because you're seeing these complex geometrical shapes that move in ways that don't really make sense. You feel like you see colors that you haven't seen before. Now, of course, this is all subjective, right? So, but it's like being able to apply a different filter to reality, and all of these substances have unique characteristics. And that's not even getting into all the, like we were talking about, it gives you more openness. It gives you different perspective on your own life. Confidence is increased. A lot of times connection to others is increased, and you see permanent change. That's another thing.
What changes for you in your breakthrough? You said you had a DMT breakthrough?
Yeah.
So what in your everyday life, you wake up, you're not on drugs, you're just like, this right, is my morning.
Okay.
What changed?
So to be honest with you, I think that if you are looking for long-term change, I think that psilocybin or LSD are much more useful tools, because what ends up happening is that the experience gets dragged out over enough time for you to be able to process it. So you're having this new experience, but you're thinking about it,
yeah,
right?
Right.
And you're asking yourself questions and coming up with answers and doing this. And it's an experience that lasts 8 hours, but can easily feel like it lasted 20 hours. Mm-hmm. The problem with DMT is like a freight train, right? It hits you yeah, so quickly, and it's such a sensory overload that it's more like an experiential shock. Mm-hmm. So I can't really say that I learned a lot from my DMT trip other than holy shit. but I do think that my LSD and psilocybin experiences made me a more open person, made me much more interested in human connection. But I mean, this happened, to be honest, early on in my life. So
yeah,
it's also difficult to distinguish like which way you would have evolved as a person with or without.
Yeah. Well, they're tools, right? They're not panacea, right? Exactly. They're not going to change your life overnight or whatever,
exactly,
right? So I think we actually need to do part two. Like I feel like I'm like step one of where I want to go with this. So like we're going to definitely do a part two, have him back on the show. I mean, we can maybe do that remotely or if you're in town or whatever. But to wrap up what we talked about today, if someone was interested in this, and we got to get a disclaimer in there before we get off, make sure we do that. What would they do, or how would they do it? Like I know there's certain, like the shamans or safe places you can go. You know, I wouldn't recommend doing a first experience like that in a party environment, like we're at an EDM concert, or you're taking something from someone you don't know. Like I highly don't recommend doing that. For me, it was a good friend. He had lots of experiences. I trust his opinion, and he got me a good thing. And he's like, this is exactly how you do it. I asked him everything, and I just did it, I think, at home. right? So like, what would you recommend if someone, and which specific psychedelic would you recommend? Opinion.
Right.
Other ways to do it, but like for you.
Yeah.
You
know. So, I mean, of course, you know, keep in mind that think about the jurisdiction in the area that you're at. If you're going to try LSD, testing kits are not that expensive. And I think it's very valuable, especially because there's a lot of research chemicals that are used to supplement for LSD. So mm-hmm. a lot of times you could buy something that they say is LSD, but it's actually not. You're going to have somewhat similar experiences, but not as powerful, not as clean. And you're taking other risks with a lot of these chemicals. So it's very, very important if you're going to do something like this. Realistically, if it's somebody that was having their first experience, I know it sounds silly, like, oh, go to Amsterdam. But I would say go to the Netherlands because you can get a regulated access to, like Brent had, the truffles.
And government regulated?
Oh, yeah. It's very well regulated.
Really? I didn't know that.
As, like, you can walk into a store where you buy cannabis and you can buy these truffles. They're not as powerful as mushrooms, but they can be very powerful, mm-hmm. especially based on the dose.
I would give you an anecdotal, since I haven't been talking too much in this episode, quick anecdotal thing about Amsterdam and the mushrooms or the truffles. I had never done them before. And you go in and, yeah, each coffee shop is regulated and they all have to have these ratings on them. On a star system mm-hmm. from 1 to 5 stars. Like, they do this much for visuals. They do this much for this, body this high, much for yeah. this. Mm-hmm. And I started talking to them and telling them I'd never done any of this before. And they're like, oh, okay, here, you want these. And they're like 2 stars, 3 stars, 4 stars. And I'm like looking over and there's 5 stars on everything. And I'm like, well, I want those. I don't want these.
They tricked him by calling it food or putting it in a food category.
So then I tell Kareem like about my experience. And the most interesting thing for me the whole time was I was in this amazing forest in their park. I was like, how is this here? This is like this little grotto of like amazing colors. And when I was done, I didn't think that I had any visual issues. But then I looked at my pictures of the amazing grotto and it was weeds. So like I just projected some colors mm-hmm. on top of them, which was very mm-hmm. interesting. But I told him, I was like, you know, I don't know if I took enough. And he's like, well, how much did you take? And I'm like, well, they told me to take like this much. So I took that much. And he's like, did they ask you what you weighed? Because you're fat, so you should have taken more.
But you still had a good experience.
I did have a good experience. Yeah. Anyway, that was my experience Brent, in Amsterdam.
To touch on what you said, because you're talking about what these experiences do, and it's not just the way that it can change you like internally, but that I can't emphasize enough how this puts like a layer on reality that just makes that beauty. You know, we all have that as humans. Like you look at a beautiful landscape, you look at something. Humans forever have looked at the world and said, wow, this is so magnificent or mm-hmm. mystical, right? There's something special about it. LSD is that on steroids. So is mushrooms, depending on where you're at, right? Like mm-hmm. you can also go so far that you're no longer in just the reality. Mm-hmm. You're picturing something in your head. But yeah, colors look brighter. Things look beautiful. And it's the biggest waste of time to take pictures of anything, because when you look at them later, you're like, no, this is not what I remember at all. Because going back to the fact that, yeah, the reality was being synthesized in your brain. It was created in your brain. Mm-hmm.
So if somebody's in the U.S., they can't make it to Amsterdam anytime soon, what would you recommend?
It's not legal anywhere, right?
Oh, fuck.
I can't recommend people break the law here.
How do they talk about it on the other shows? I'll tell everybody what I did. This is just my experience, okay? So I did.
You might not want to admit to any felonies.
A microdose of LSD. And I did that a few times and kind of got used to that, whatever. That was cool. And this is more to the point of being in the show where I was really sold on it when it didn't have addictive properties, because I got to a point where I would actually be resistant to taking it because I feel like it would stimulate me too much at times and I would get a headache. And so, it had like a physical negative reaction to prevent me from overusing it, right? Mm-hmm. I would do very small amounts, like a corner tip. And the most I ever did, I think, was like a half stamp. And we went down to Barton Springs, which is a natural cold water spring in Austin. And it was an amazing experience just being in the water. I find that I'm generally nicer to people and I want to talk to them more interested in them when I'm on it, things Absolutely. Like that. So there's like a lot of these benefits of just heightening your experience a little bit, getting you a little bit out of your dogma, and just maybe getting you to question in who you are, what you're doing, and where you are at, and connect with people and environment and things a little bit more. And so that worked for me. I also tried some mushrooms before, and I guess I might not have taken enough, but I didn't have a great experience. I took those and I laid down in my room and I was like, when is this going to be over? I felt like really heavy. I didn't really want to get up or anything. And it wasn't like a really good experience. It wasn't a crazy negative experience, right? But it wasn't a really good one. So it wasn't a bad trip, but you know, again, it's like these things that they self-regulate a little bit.
So since you did want some advice, I will say one thing. I don't want to say anything about how you can source the material or not. That's obviously up to the individual. However, if you're having your first psychedelic experience or your second or third, the thing that I could recommend the most is very few people actually plan out their trip. So I would recommend, number one, doing it at home where you're going to be in a safe environment, because at different times, it's going to feel like a long time. And you might have times where the best thing you could do is lay down on your own couch. Right?
Yeah.
And then actually plan ahead of time a different list of experiential experiences. So for example, have a playlist and know that at some point during your trip, you're going to sit down, you're going to lay down in your bed, put your headphones on, and listen to music. Listen to music that makes you feel good, positive, whatever you like, whatever you're interested in. Mm-hmm. I promise you, you've never experienced music like that. Have a movie that you want to watch later, ideally something stylistic, something that has very bright colors. You're going to experience it differently, right? So a lot of people just take the drug and see what happens. But if you're being very kind to your future self, if you plan your trip ahead of time.
Yeah, that's advice I received. Also, my one buddy, he would always bring a notebook and pen, because depending on the time through the process, he was a little bit more lucid, and he just like breakthrough ideas. And, you know, obviously Jobs is famous for talking about how LSD helped him make ideas or whatever. But again, I don't think you should be going into these things with these expectations about, like, you know, inventing some miracle product or changing or solving your childhood trauma or anything like that. These are tools that can maybe help you in the right direction, open you up a little bit, but they're not a panacea for that type of stuff, right?
It's just a unique experience. Yeah. It's just a tool.
Brent, do you have anything you'd like to add? Maybe you could do the disclaimer.
I don't even know. We might have to re-record the disclaimer, but the normal disclaimer is that the members of the Ancestral Mind podcast are not nutritional advisors, but we're going way beyond that. So we are not in any way medical professionals. We are not in any way...
We're not a shamanistic degree yet.
Yeah, we have not been given the ability to distribute any peyote.
We're not recommending you break the law.
Yes, we are absolutely not recommending you break the law. These are all entertainment devices and purposes. Even our experiences may not have even been true. We were just giving you entertainment.
I was just about to say, in fact, everything we just said on the show is not true.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is provided for your entertainment. Much like wrestling is, you know, maybe The Rock is not such a bad guy. Maybe he is a bad guy. We don't really know. That's kind of what we were doing today here on the Ancestral Mind podcast. Colin, you know what else we forgot to do?
You don't need to do an ad today because we should just keep it separate.
All right. We forgot to do an ad. No ads today. Ad-free show. What a great experience.
This show was not sponsored by anybody at all. And we were
That's true. That's a good point. Yeah. This show is barely even approved by our own mouths. So
it's definitely not sponsored.
Listen.
Kareem, where can they find you if they want to connect with you?
Well, you can check out the Crypto Basic podcast, of course. And I'm on Twitter as Dr. Rungood.
How do you spell that?
D-R... Run good.
Oh, are run you, good. Yeah, I thought it was run actually good. run good, like an Indian name or something.
No. I run
so
good.
So you're
at
not
life.
Actually a doctor, though.
No, okay. I'm not a doctor. I was just making fun of the fact that I run pretty good at life. I feel pretty lucky.
Yeah. Well, in poker, if you could teach me how to run good, I will pay you handsomely for it. So, Brent, that's it. I think it's a wrap.
Yeah, that's it.
Make sure you like and subscribe on iTunes and all the places, and send us feedback at ancestralmind@gmail.com. Make sure you let us know. We'll have Kareem, Dr. Rungood, back on the show to talk more about fake experiences and things that didn't happen.
Totally didn't happen.
Relating to psychedelics. So that'll be a fun storytelling time.
Please do not break the law. It's like we all came to the realization at the same time.
Maybe we shouldn't have said some of these things.
Man, yeah, I don't know if that was the best idea. I mean,